DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we learn how to harness the power of the waves.
It's a mini power station in its own right. It uses the wave motion to produce electricity inside the structure.
An urban gardener experiments with her own urban fish farm.
And here I have some huge zucchini plants that took over the whole garden. Hidden, you can see some beetroots and, well, I have an invasion of strawberries also.
And Japan appoints a new nuclear watchdog after backing down from plans to phase out nuclear power.
It is easier to say we want to restore trust, but it will be up to the people who judge our every action that trust will be regained.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We're going to spend a lot of today's program thinking about innovation. Now, I get on this mic each week and tell you a lot of stories about the damage that we're doing to the planet. Now, those stories are important, but we also have to look at the options for protecting the planet and living sustainably. So we're off to visit people who are trying out new ways of living. Their goal is to continue meeting their own needs while reducing the stress they put on the planet. Our first report takes us to the German capital, Berlin, where one woman, Valentina Karga, is experimenting with food production. Now, she doesn't own a big plot of land. She's farming right in her own garden. She no longer battles her way through the crowded aisles of the local supermarket. Instead, she's growing her own food and raising her own fish. Karga is a fellow at Berlin's University of Arts, and her garden is part science experiment, part art installation. DW correspondent Gavin Blackburn went along to meet her for lunch at her house in Berlin.
The classic 1970s sitcom The Good Life portrayed the idea of self-sufficiency as a bit of a joke, a noble ideal, but one ultimately doomed to failure in an urban context. For Valentina Karga, on the other hand, self-sufficiency means lots of hard work. Part of her project sees her trade surplus food for things she can't produce herself. So I'm just off to an organic supermarket to pick up one or two items before heading to her house.
Hello.
7 Euro macht's bitte.
Hello, hi. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
I've got a little goodie bag of stuff for you. You can have a dig in.
Wow, you brought a lot. Flour. Ah, good, great. I just wanted to bake a bread, and nobody brings me flour and yeast. Chocolate? Many people bring me chocolate, actually, because they think that I'm losing weight or that I don't have anything sweet to eat. But thank you, that's lovely. What shall I give you back? I have still lots of potatoes.
Well, we can have a dig around in the garden. Should we go have a look?
Yeah. And here I have some huge zucchini plants that took over the whole garden. Hidden, you can see some beetroots and, well, I have an invasion of strawberries also, because I planted one and I didn't know that strawberries make these really long branches, if you see here. And yeah, here these are beans. They do really well with strawberries, so that's why I planted them together. But now everything is taken over with the zucchini plant.
So Valentina, the top corner of the garden looks very rustic, and in comparison this all looks very technical. We've got a pool here full of water, pipes everywhere going into boxes full of plants. Can you just explain what this all is?
This is called an aquaponics system. What actually is, it's like some sort of hydroponics, which is plants cultivated only in water and not soil, because it's been found that plants actually need the soil only for the nutrients and for no other reason. So therefore you can just plant them in water using these little clay bowls. There are these. So it's just to hold the roots, like really easy, low-cost material. And the idea is that that the fish waste becomes the nutrient for the plants, but then the plants clean the water to send it back to the fish clean. So it's like a natural filter. It's like a closed-loop system.
With the exception of the donated lentils, everything for today's soup has come fresh from the garden. The potatoes and carrots have just been dug up, fresh mint has been picked, even chilli for some added spice. And everything is going to be cooked on a homemade wood-burning rocket stove. Well, for almost a month now, you've been at the mercy of Mother Nature. What have been the harshest lessons so far?
The most painful moment for me was when the fish died. And that was because I actually left. I had to go for a family wedding in Greece, and I had left some people giving food to the fish, but then something went wrong with the connections and the pump, and they were not experts on it, so they didn't know what to do. And then when they contacted me, it was already too late. So one thing is that you can never leave when you have such a system. That's a lesson I've learned.
Has the project maybe made you realise just how many unnecessary things we eat?
Yes, definitely. Some people bring me already unnecessary stuff because they can't imagine that I can live without cookies or without chocolate. It's much nicer to make all the things yourself. It's more of an experiment to see how, in what extent I can combine my lifestyle, like the city lifestyle, with this lifestyle, which is, in our minds, more of a rural lifestyle.
So we've just talked about all of these delicious things out of the garden, all these fresh vegetables and fresh herbs and stuff. But I have to ask you about your own personal waste.
I don't understand why in the contemporary society is such a taboo. What I do with my own excrement is a compost toilet, so I'm going to make my own compost to use next year as a fertilizer for the garden. But you can also make biogas, for instance, from excrement. So in any case, you can regenerate something useful to reuse again. So it's totally wrong, the concept that is just waste, because it's not. This notion of waste, in my opinion, it shouldn't exist at all, because nothing is really waste, and that actually our food waste becomes soil again, where we can plant something and eat again from it. So it's just a process of transformation.
Gavin Blackburn, DW, Berlin.
We're going to leave Valentina's garden now and hit the streets. We're walking the roads of the world's cities, and it's congested. Every day, traffic jams in New York, Seoul, London, and right here in Bonn pump exhaust into the air. There's a constant battle for parking spaces, and more cars are motoring their way into urban areas. Now, fewer cars on the road means less CO2 in the air, but is it practical? The convenience of having a car has brought ease to a lot of people's lives. Think of the parent carting around two-year-olds, or the grandmother picking up groceries, long-distance commuters who can't afford to live in the city center. But does everyone who needs access to a car have to own one, or can we share? Our next report takes a closer look at car sharing, where people rent a car for just an hour or two in the German city of Karlsruhe. The city is leading the way in innovative transportation and has been named the car-sharing capital of Germany. Kate Hersheim has more.
This is where plenty of cars are parked, and there is the key deposit safe.
I'm weaving my bike through Karlsruhe traffic, together with Anja Ort from the private car-sharing company Stadtmobil. She's about to show me one of the more than 150 car-sharing parking stations which are dotted throughout the city.
Most of the stations are placed with very easy access to public transports. This one is might be 5 minutes walk, but usually they're very close at bus stops, tram stops.
To join Stadtmobil, you have to pay a €330 deposit and a €70 registration fee. And then you book the car you want, either by calling them on the phone, making an online request, or using a mobile phone app.
Once you book the car, you go to the deposit box and hold your card in front of it so it opens and you get the key. So you've got the reservation dates. I've just reserved it for 1 hour.
What cars in general do you offer?
We maintain a huge range of different cars, all low emission, compact cars, medium-sized cars, estate cars,
people carrier or, well, minibuses, full-size vans, and even some convertibles, cabriolets, some fun cars, I would say.
The cars cost a different amount, depending on their size. To borrow a Mini, for example, costs 98 cents an hour, plus 19 cents per kilometre, with fuel included in the price. Car sharing works out to be more cost-effective than owning a car if you drive less than about 150 kilometres a week.
Shall we have a look inside?
Car sharing in Karlsruhe started nearly two decades ago. Back then, they just had a few vehicles. Now Stadtmobil has more than 500 cars, servicing 8,000 customers. The last few years in particular have seen numbers boom, says Anja Ort.
It's the amount of cars we have that makes it so attractive for everybody. Plus, fuel is getting more and more expensive, and maintaining your own private car is so expensive as well. And car sharing is so easy. You can just book a car over the phone or with your mobile phone. And especially for younger people, a car is no status symbol anymore as it used to be.
Just one or two more and then it's almost full.
Over on the other side of town, Angeline Watson is getting her two children ready to go out. Her family got rid of its car and joined Stadtmobil 2.5 years ago. Watson is a big fan of the service's flexibility.
It's great. We can choose if it's just the four of us, a small car, but if we have visitors, we have a bigger car then. If we need to move furniture, we can use a van.
But even so, she and her family only use the car sharing service about once a month.
In Karlsruhe, it's really easy to ride a bike. It's even easier than driving a car. If we want to go anywhere further, we can take the train or the tram, and we use car sharing for spontaneous weekend trips.
And this is actually the interesting thing about car sharing. Experts have found out that it's successful in cities such as Karlsruhe, where people don't need to own a car to get around, because they have excellent alternatives, such as public transport. Watson doesn't feel disadvantaged in any way not owning her own car.
No, because I think it's better to find other solutions than driving, to ride our bikes or to take public transport. It's an adventure for the kids and it's, for the most part, cheaper for us.
While 9 out of 10 car-sharing users in Karlsruhe are private individuals, the service is attracting an increasing number of firms. One of them is Karlsruhe City Council. According to Mayor Klaus Stapf, the service works because council employees don't have to waste time looking for a vehicle.
Because the net of locations is very good, this is possible for us. We have in the city some locations where about 6 or 10 cars are, so it's very probable that you get your car. And booking is very easy. This is also important. You can go to the internet, can look, okay, this car is free, and 10 minutes later you can sit in the car and use it.
Here at peak hour in the centre of Karlsruhe, thousands of cars are whizzing past. It's a scene that's being repeated in cities all around the world. It's estimated that there are 10 billion vehicles on the world's roads, and this figure is expected to double by 2020. This means that car emission levels, road congestion, and competition for parking spaces are only going to increase. But with cities as diverse as Shanghai, Sydney, Paris, and London all turning to car sharing as a way of clearing their car-clogged streets, perhaps there is hope for the future after all. This is Kate Hairsine for DW in Karlsruhe.
We've been following a story in Sweden this week where forest protection advocates have blocked a mining project that was moving ahead in the Onare Forest. This is an ancient wildlife area located on Gotland Island in the Baltic Sea. It's full of old pine trees and limestone plains dotted with sparse prairie-like vegetation. It's also home to a number of protected species, such as the large blue butterfly and the Montagu harrier, a long-winged migratory bird. Swedish mining company Nordkalk has been trying to establish a limestone quarry in the region. They declined to talk to Deutsche Welle about the court proceedings, but if you want to know more about that story, you can find our report at dw.de/environment. We're going to look now at some other stories making the headlines this week. Here's Jared Reed with the Eco News.
Japan has backed down from its plan to phase out nuclear power by 2040. The plan drew strong opposition from business groups and communities with economies that depend on nuclear power plants. Instead, Tokyo has created a new agency to oversee the nuclear industry. The government dismantled its previous nuclear monitoring body following criticism that its members were too close to nuclear plant operators and had failed to take the necessary steps to prevent a disaster like Fukushima. Shinichi Tanaka is the head of the new Nuclear Regulation Authority. Here's what he had to say after taking his new position. It is easier to say we want to restore trust, but it will be up to the people who judge our every action that trust will be regained. Anti-nuclear advocates have criticised Tanaka, pointing out that he was once an executive involved in the promotion of nuclear energy development. But that said, his new committee has acknowledged the public's wish to move away from nuclear power. They've also called on the government to phase out nuclear power and develop the renewable energy sector. US experts monitoring climate change have confirmed that the Arctic Ocean's sea ice cover shrank to an alarming record low this week. Satellite images showed the oceanic North Pole's ice cap now spans just 3.4 million square kilometres. The previous low was a little more than 4 million square kilometres. That was in 2007. Ice in the Arctic melts in summer and grows in winter, and it started growing again on Monday. The National Snow and Ice Data Centre says global warming caused by human activity has melted more sea ice and made it thinner. Greenpeace has warned that the rapid growth of Australia's mining sector threatens to turn part of the state of Queensland into a leading emitter of carbon dioxide. The environmental group says continued growth will undermine efforts worldwide to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Greenpeace has examined 9 proposed mega mines in the Galilee Basin, which have a capacity to produce 330 million tonnes of coal a year for export. The mines would largely service markets in India and China, but operating a maximum output, the mines would nearly double Australia's total coal production. A mischievous elephant in Cambodia has been captured in a 3-day sting operation and will now live in captivity. The 16-year-old elephant has been on a rampage for about a year, cutting a path of destruction through the province of Koh Kong. He damaged buildings, injured cattle and charged at vehicles. Ahead of his capture, wildlife expert Nick Mark explained the importance of capturing the animal.
He's caused a lot of problems along the National Road number 48, caused several car crashes. And he's been making inroads into the sugarcane plantation. And local people are kind of upset and a little bit angry. Though they all love him, they're kind of angry. And if we don't capture him, then he will cause trouble and ultimately will probably be killed himself.
Sarkor the elephant joins 5 other rescued Asian elephants at a zoo near the capital Phnom Penh. It's unlikely he'll be returned to the wild, but there are hopes he'll be put to good use and partner with one of the zoo's female elephants. Snow kiting may be a threat to Norway's wild reindeer population. The sport has become extremely popular. The riders wear skis and are pulled along by a kite. But it's terrifying for reindeer. According to a new study published in the Journal of Applied Animal Behaviour Science, reindeer are more afraid of snow kiters than skiers because of the kite. This has led to a reduction in habitat and allowed the reindeer less time to feed. Instead, they're spending more time retreating and hiding. There are currently no restrictions in Norway on the use of snow kites. The researchers have suggested better management of recreational ski trails to reduce the effects of snow kiting on reindeer. Severe flooding in Nigeria has left thousands homeless. The flooding is particularly bad in the centre of the country and forced many to seek shelter on higher ground. The floods have washed away farmlands and houses in most areas and cut off road networks. Bolivia has declared the freshwater pink dolphin a national treasure, and the country's president, Evo Morales, has tasked the armed forces with protecting the habitats in which the dolphins live. Erosion, industrial waste and logging in the Amazon have polluted the waters where these dolphins live. The new legislation not only calls for increased protection, it also makes it illegal to fish freshwater pink dolphins.
That was Jared Reed with the Eco News. Our last report today looks at innovations in energy production. Now, 70% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. Imagine if we could harness the power of the waves and the tides. That could be the answer to energy shortage and bring an end to energy production that's harmful to the environment. This isn't a new idea. The first wave energy device was patented 200 years ago. But it's only now, against the background of climate change, that marine energy finally seems to be making waves. Europe is turning its attention to Scotland, where turbulent waters offer endless potential for marine energy production. DW correspondent Irene Quayle visited the European Marine Energy Centre, where energy developers are testing their prototypes in real conditions. She has this report.
So this is the EMEX wave test site at Ballycoo, just outside of Stromness in Orkney. We're standing on the west coast of Orkney. And just out to the south there, you can see the Aquamarine Power Oyster 800 device operating just in the distance. Today, we're at around 2 metres waves. On average, that is about average for us, but the highest that we've had on site is it gets up to 17 metres.
The Oyster 800 is a yellow object bobbing up and down in the waves, as Lisa McKenzie from EMEC explains to me. In fact, what we see is just the tip of a shallow water energy system. Around 15 metres down, the yellow flap is attached by a hinge to a platform on the seabed. The wave movement enables it to pump water at high pressure to drive turbines in a building back on the shore. Further out to sea floats Pilamis, the sea snake, a long red cylinder, its various linked sections undulating with the waves. In fact, it's a mini power station in its own right. It uses the wave motion to produce electricity inside the structure. The floating machine is plugged into a socket on the seabed, where it sends the electricity back to land. These are just two technologies being tested here at EMEC on Orkney. Along the beach, we don some obligatory safety clothing and Lisa McKenzie opens the door of the green building that holds the secrets to EMEC's success.
So this is the EMEC substation. The developers connect up to the EMEC cables, which then feed into the substation here. The substation then connects into the grid, which is the Stromness power plant, just a few miles away from here. Each of the cables have fibre optics within, which allows all the devices to be monitored remotely.
Once that grid served to provide this remote location with electricity from coal-fired power stations in the south of the mainland. Now this system will have to be extended massively to transport the renewable energy from Scotland's invaluable natural resources, ocean and wind, in the other direction. The developers of marine power describe it as a benign technology with little impact on the natural environment. Compared with the dangers of climate change caused by fossil fuel emissions, any negative effects would seem minimal. Still, here and in laboratories on the mainland, scientists are trying to keep pace with the speed of development, monitoring whether the new structures in the water pose any threat to the marine ecosystem. 20 minutes' hike up a hill overlooking the beach, a figure well wrapped up against the wind opens the shutters of an old Coast Guard station. Jim Williams is starting his observation shift.
We're about a quarter of a mile from the coastline and we can look right out to the sea to the west with a horizon of about 40 miles away, but we only actually monitor within about 5 kilometres of the shore here.
So what wildlife are you actually looking at?
It's whatever's going past. It's actually the wildlife that's using the sea, not stuff that birds are flying past. So we're observing cetaceans in particular. So we have things like minke whales, dolphins, various species, quite a lot of seals, and then, of course, the whole variety of seabird life, which includes birds like fulmars, gannets, auks in particular. We get quite a lot of auks. Depends on the time of year. And the idea is to monitor what's out here currently and then to see how that, if anything that's being put in the sea in terms of energy devices makes any difference to the way the wildlife behaves or in actual fact what, you know, if they actually, maintain their presence here.
Back down in Stromness, in a sizeable business complex, Eileen Linkletter is the marketing manager for EMEC.
There are more machines here in Orkney being tested than any other single site in the world. We are an island group, and we sit right in the middle of a North Atlantic crossroads, sandwiched between the North Sea and the Atlantic. So along our west coast, we get the full force of the Atlantic Ocean crashing in on our shores, creating large waves. And between the islands, we get very fast-flowing tidal streams because of the change in tide and the change in direction of the tide being channeled in between the islands, kind of like a funnel, which makes the water run very fast.
Within the next 10 to 15 years, some of the marine technologies being tested here are expected to be commercially viable. In Scotland, technological development and the regulatory framework for the deployment of marine devices have been happening in parallel. This is just part of a wider, ambitious programme to produce 100% of the country's energy needs from renewables by 2020. The Scottish Nationalist Government, keen for independence from London, has given top priority to using the country's offshore experience with oil and gas to become a leader in the fledgling marine sector. Fergus Ewing is Scotland's Minister for Energy, Enterprise and Tourism.
The applications in cumulo for wave and tidal projects for the Pentland Firth are of the order of 1.7 gigawatts. It's a massive quantity, around about a quarter to a third of the total electricity consumed in Scotland. So we want to see a wave and tidal energy succeed. And I think it was Barack Obama who said that the country that develops new forms of renewable energy will be the country that leads the world economy. And that sounds like quite a good prospect to aim for.
Ambitious goals for a small country of 5 million. But up on the Northern Isles of Orkney, Eileen Linkletter is already feeling the buzz of the energy revolution. She says the growing industry has already been very important for the local economy and the community.
I myself was born and brought up in Orkney, so I know firsthand from growing up beside the sea the power that's there for harvesting. And now it's become a professional job and has created many more jobs besides. And I think the most exciting thing is I'm seeing so many more young people being able to come back to Orkney and work. Now we're seeing great graduate opportunities for young engineers, scientists, business people to actually come here and work in an island community, enjoy an exciting career and have the fantastic quality of life that island living can offer.
Thank you to Irene Quayle for that report. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. If you want to know more about the state of the planet, you can find us online anytime at dw.de/environment. We'll be right back here again next week. For now, I'm Saroja Coelho. From everyone here in Bonn, thanks for listening.